One of us will be up at some point this week. Because we have other stuff going out. So, and I'll call him tomorrow and find out what's up in the address.
All right, we're on, Joe. Okay. All right. I don't know who this is, but welcome.
Amen.
Sorry, it's my name is actually Jean Fitzsimmons, and I did this login from my church, and I can't seem to change it on my screen.
That's okay. We have you.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you're a regular with us, right, Jean? You've been here before.
Yeah, I've been here before. I took your online hormone course and met you at the last AMM. So thanks for all you do.
You coming to this one, AMMG? They got me doing. I was supposed to do.
I'm trying to. I have some mom care issues. My mom is bedridden, so I'm trying to figure that out.
Been there, done that.
Yeah. So hoping to be there.
Okay. They had me doing 3 lectures this time, so.
Well, I'm sure that will be excellent.
They gave me 45 minutes to do thyroid and cortisol.
Oh, that's really ridiculous. Yeah.
45 minutes.
Yeah, so, one or the other, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay. So, and we have your email address, correct? You're on our list?
Yes. Yes, I am. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. So, how are the hand paws?
We're good.
You behaving yourself?
I'm trying to.
Well, that's no fun. So,
just enjoying this. Snow again today.
Yep, here we go. So, you know, I voted for you for the Hall of Fame this year. So,
you did,
Pro Football Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah.
You got slighted in your playing days, so I think we should vote you in as a veteran. Okay. So, if you're not familiar with us, we usually start around 5:00. Dr. McCullough has assured us he will be here. So, we're anxiously awaiting his arrival. So, till then, just relax. And maybe Gerald can tell us some stories. Can you tell us some stories, Gerald?
Yeah.
church.
Or not.
Or not. Admit it.
You can tell the stories. We'll listen.
No, I want to hear your stories.
I don't have no stories.
Oh, come on. You have to have stories.
No, not really. Those things going with you.
They're going.
Busy, 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 huh?
Well, we otherwise I get myself in trouble.
No.
Better to keep me busy.
See if I could show them.
I have you as a co-host, Joe.
Yeah. What it looks like out here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here we are in lovely downtown Reno.
Lovely snowing. Reno. Starting to stink.
Mm-hmm. I moved 2,500 miles to live in this weather. Could have stayed where I was.
Yes, you should have.
From the Peanut Gallery. Where are you these days?
I'm in Scranton.
Still in Scranton, okay.
Scranton, but, globally, I'm on Zoom everywhere.
Yes, well, yeah, we all do.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, we're doing it right now, right?
Exactly. I have a colleague at the American Holistic Nursing Association, and she used to say, you need to move out of Scranton and move to Topeka, Kansas. I'm like, listen, if I'm going to move anywhere, it's not Topeka, Kansas, honey. Not going to happen.
I know. Once you get, the cold dust in you, I keep threatening to make a tour back there. I'm going to bring a whole crew of friends from here. We do the Scranton coal mine tour and take them to the pizza capital of the world. Every time I ask them what the pizza capital of the world is, they never know.
There you go. Well, I got an Irish citizenship, so you never know. I might be moving there.
Going to be moving to Old Forge, Pennsylvania?
Old Forge. No, Ireland.
Oh, Ireland.
Yeah, no. I don't think I'll be moving over.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Dr. Bill, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Man, so, you're gonna have a barn burner tonight.
I hope so. So he assured me. I get nervous. It's 5 of, and he hasn't signed on yet. He assured me he'd be here.
Ah. Oh yeah.
He's a man of few words.
Last week and
yesterday, and he said, all I get was, I reminded him of this, and he says, affirmative. That's what I get.
There you go.
Yeah, I bet he learned that all by experience. Yeah.
We're grateful that he would even say yes to us.
Yes, that's right. That's right. We are blessed to be able to question him. Yeah, talk with him.
He's a worldwide figure, and anybody on here who doesn't like what he has to say, that's okay. But he was at our conference last year.
Mm-hmm.
I almost think that's one of the reasons we got kicked out. Actually, they didn't mention it.
Yeah, well,
you've been kicked out of worse places.
Yeah,
worse than the AOA? I'm not so sure about that. So, he was on one of our webinars last year, and he was at our conference live. And
yes, I saw him there. Yeah, that's right. I recall that in Las Vegas. Yep.
Yeah. And so he's been very generous to us, really. I'm really, kind of surprised, somebody like, is, usually the celebrities don't have time for us.
Well, that's right. But I tell you, he may have some good new information. There's all kinds of data that's come about in the past year, and right. We've kind of all moved on from COVID and haven't looked as much. But I think when you start looking at the long haul data that's coming out, the acknowledgments that are being made by, they're kind of, now that nobody's looking, they're letting the truth kind of slip out a little bit. And You know, they go, no, that was there all the time.
Yeah, right.
Except we hid it from you for until we were done, told that we were done with you, you know. But, yeah, seems pretty to be bad.
A lot of Ralph Cramden, those of you not old enough to remember Ralph Cramden, used to go, hamana, hamana, hamana. He's always looking for a get rich quick scheme, and then when it blew up in his face, he would be scrambling to undo it. So,
yep. Well, that's great. All right. Well, I'll see what's going on. Okay. I'll hit here and see if I got McCullough's number. I'll see if I can text.
Yeah, tell him we're anxiously awaiting him.
Yeah. All right, we'll see what I can come up with here. Probably in Thailand or someplace.
Oh, here he is. He's on.
Oh, there we go.
So we're going to ask everybody to mute themselves, please. Saw his name on here, and did he join or did he get knocked off? Oh, no, he's on. So, Dr. McCullough, thank you for coming.
Well, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, we hear you fine. I'll be letting folks in. Please let everybody, please everybody mute yourself. I think you need no introduction, sir. You are our hero. We're seeing the top of your forehead, though. It looks like you're looking down.
Yeah, I'm trying to get the slides set up here. Okay.
So those of you who don't know that we are, we were the American Osteopathic Society of Rheumatic Diseases, and Dr. McCullough, you probably don't know this, but they decertified us last summer.
Is that right?
Ridiculous. After 50 years, they said we strayed from our mission of rheumatology. they unceremoniously, just in the middle of the night, it was a kangaroo court. I went to the meeting in Chicago. It was, it was voted 530-1 to decertify us. And it's a bit of a story. I won't waste your time with it, but, so we, it's certainly not on the, scale that you've been subjected to, but we've been canceled.
So. You know, at the society level, I was the president of I'm a founding member of the Cardiorenal Society of America. We had 600 members, about 6,000 followers. And, you know, I was the president, the standing president, and without any phone call, without any due process, no board meeting, the society was dissolved. So it's still, how does that happen?
Anyway, so we're carrying on anyway. We've been working, throughout the year. We're here every Tuesday night. We have an integrative medical, meeting. We have a great group of practitioners, core group. We always pull in some others, and, we are truly grateful for your presence last year at our conference in Las Vegas. You probably don't need to know where you are half the time. You seem to be everywhere. And, you were on one of our webinars last year, and I just out of the blue said, well, let me see if he'll come on again. And so we're really, truly grateful, because we know you're extremely busy and you have there's a lot of pressures. So we want you to know that you have a admiration society out here.
Okay. Well, gosh, you know, I'm sorry to hear about that decertification, although I'm not surprised. This goes into additional list. I think the FBI is behind it. I think if you ultimately would do a search, the FBI would approach the parent organization and then work to decertify you. I think that the FBI was inside Twitter. What's going on is a national security operation, not a public health crisis, a national security operation. So anybody who's going to potentially cast doubt on these vaccines is going to be in the targets of the FBI,
we,
I think.
So. We never said anything about vaccines at all, one way or the other. We never even came up in, you know, any of our topics. And, the two ironies, and then I'm going to let you take over and do your thing, was one gentleman who said he was from the Education Committee said he looked at our program from 2000 from Seattle, which I don't know when that was because I've never been in Seattle in my life. I never even stopped in the airport there to change planes. And he specifically mentioned a date, it was April 15th, and that our programming was substandard. And then, but that exact same day, the same gentleman had sent us a 5-year recertification on April 15th, which is the longest that the AOA grants. So we'll figure that. It was just a kangaroo court. So, sir, I'm going to let you take over. We truly appreciate it. And, you know, whenever, however much time you need, fine. And if you need to go at all, anytime, that's fine.
Okay. We'll have a briefer presentation and then, we have plenty of time for questions. People normally, it's just, you know, everyone wants to get kind of an update and then questions. So we'll do this.
And everybody, please mute yourselves.
I was introduced. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I'm a practicing internist and cardiologist in Dallas, Texas. And for the last 3 years, I've become a COVID expert. I trained in epidemiology at University of Michigan, but I'm a standard academic allopathic physician. I don't have any training in holistic or integrative medicine. And from the outset, though, I've taken the view that we should have always treated high-risk patients and helped them the best we could. And we should always have taken a fair, balanced view on the vaccine. So let's get into it. Five quick points. Oh, I have a book out since the last time I talked to you, I believe, called Courage to Face COVID-19. You can pick it up on the website, couragetofacecovid.com. It's got 1,000 five-star ratings on Amazon, bestseller, multiple categories. It's written by a full-time best-selling author, John Leake, and I did the medical parts. But it's a fast-reading book about how the advent of early treatment came about and the types of suppression we came into face from what we call the biopharmaceutical complex, or this very well-organized grouping of entities that is advancing mass vaccination on the world. Everything I'm going to say has been entered into the National Archives, the U.S. Senate record. I've testified there 3 times, most recently December 7th, 2022. So we have taken the issues as high as we can. One of the cases for the Biden vaccine mandates relied on my testimony and that of Jay Bhattacharya, were both frequent contributors for Fox News, and that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I've done everything I can as a practicing doctor and a scientist and a public figure. So here are the points. The first point is negligible asymptomatic spread. Our U.S. CDC now admits over this they've made major mistakes in the pandemic response. One of the mistakes has been to follow modeling studies which conjectured that SARS-CoV-2 was the first virus that spread asymptomatically, the first respiratory infection that spread asymptomatically. Tuberculosis doesn't spread that way. Influenza, none of the other respiratory infections spread that way. And so these modeling studies that suggested 30 to 50% of the spread was from well person to well person were never supported. And what we know now is 2 papers, one by Cao, over 10 million Chinese, and the other one by Zachary Madewell, demonstrated that less than 1% of spread was from an asymptomatic person to an asymptomatic person. It's always from a sick person to a susceptible person. The other big update that came from this paper by Tom Jefferson at the Cochrane Collaboration, this is probably the final one on the topic, 78 studies, 12 randomized trials in masking. And what was found is that public masking had little to no effect at all. And even surgical masks versus N95, one of the studies in the healthcare setting, didn't make a difference at all. To rely on masks or spend time on public policy on masks was a giant mistake. by our agencies. And as we sit here today, our CDC says that the only time we need to wear a mask is when we're encountering a COVID patient in the hospital or any other patient in respiratory isolation. So all the effort on masking turned out to be a complete waste of time. The next point is asymptomatic testing is not supportable. You know, the FDA has never cleared the nasal PCR antigen test for asymptomatic routine testing. They're only cleared to test an acutely sick patient as a diagnostic aid in COVID-19. Many studies have found the same thing. This one from the Big Ten showed that the rate of positivity from weekly testing in athletes was 0.44% and in non-athletes is 0.88%. So targeting the athletes was not advisable. And this paper by Connor and colleagues, large workplace study, weekly testing, when it was positive, 0.35 positivity rate, and it turns out 62% of them were false positives. World Health Organization said in June of 2021, don't do asymptomatic testing. It has a very low yield, and when it's positive, it's yielding false positive cases, and in fact, that was shown. The third point is that natural immunity protects against severe disease. So this is an important point. This paper by Chimatelli and colleagues demonstrates that the efficacy of pre-existing immunity now is 97.3% against the second infection causing hospitalization and death. And there was no difference among age groups, and this was durable out to 15 months. So this is a very impressive result. This is a group from Qatar that's doing great work on this. And then this paper, I think, is one of the most impressive papers so far. Chin and colleagues, New England Journal of Medicine, 59,000 prisoners, 17,000 staff, all congregate setting. They know all the cases. The bottom sets of rows in the table important. If the infection, the first infection was through the Delta or Omicron eras of time, there was a 0% chance of hospitalization and death on a second infection. Even if we don't know prior infection status nowadays with Omicron, in this giant study, there was only one death. And you can see here several dozen hospitalizations, even in the unknown status. But if your patient knows they've previously had COVID now, they're protected against severe outcomes. When you get called by a patient and they say they have COVID, the most important question you can ask them is this your first episode or a second episode? The fourth point is that COVID is a treatable illness. It's always been a treatable illness. Chances are your society got in the crosshairs of some powerful entities because your society may have been advocating for the treatment of patients prior to the hospital. And it should be self-evident. The only way to prevent a hospitalization is to do something in the pre-hospital phase, whether or not someone's been vaccinated or not. These are the two papers that I marshaled in 2020. I now have 60 papers in COVID-19, among the most, I think, of anybody in the field. And what the papers proposed is that we should go ahead and start treating patients before the hospital phase and before large conclusive randomized trials. A trial to be large and conclusive would have to have over 20,000, probably over 40,000 patients, prospective, double-blind, have to be multi-drug since we're in the multi-drug environment. And these trials have not even been planned, let alone done. So what we proposed is that we take the precautionary principle. We don't treat everybody, but just high-risk individuals, that this was a mass casualty event. We look for drugs that had a signal of benefit from all the available evidence, acceptable safety, and then use drugs in combination. It's just what we do in the setting of a pandemic. We should never and let people get sick and die. This is how the illness was conceptualized. To this day, the National Institutes of Health and Infectious Disease Society of America don't have this concept of the illness. But myself and co-authors believe that there was a viral proliferation phase early on that lasted about 2 weeks, but certainly most of it's in the first few days. It trips off a cytokine injury phase of inflammation. The lead cytokine is interleukin-6. And then that kicks off a thrombosis phase and microthrombosis being most common in the lungs. And the mechanism of hypoxemia in COVID-19 respiratory illness is actually microthrombosis in the lungs. That was shown in autopsy studies by the Italians. You see all the constitutional signs and symptoms, the test positivity down at the bottom, and then the symptom overlay, cough and difficulty breathing, probably cytokine injury. By the time we have chest heaviness and desaturation is microthrombosis. Before Omicron, it was a long illness. It was a 30-day illness. The majority of people who died actually died in the hospital. And then our response is up on top, intracellular anti-infectives, antiviral antibodies, corticosteroids, immunomodulators, antiplatelet drugs, and anticoagulants. In short, it takes about 4 to 6 drugs in combination to treat a serious outpatient COVID patient. And it's not so specific on which drugs. We simply need drugs to handle each one of the phases of the illness, and we can get the patients through it. This is a more modern rendition of a multi-drug protocol called McCullough Protocol. And at the top, we state that patients should undergo risk stratification. Those under age 50, otherwise healthy, aren't going to need prescription treatment. They simply use the over-the-counter bundle that I've shown here. The antiviral, by the way, in this skinny yellow box is famotidine, 80 milligrams a day, well supported by observational data. Again, no large definitive trials. Vitamin D has got a very extensive positive literature, observationally randomized trials, and the other nutraceuticals and supplements thought to be helpful. Patients undergo watchful waiting, 5-day quarantine back at work, and so they're in good shape. So, 75% of people don't need treatment. Now, down the middle are patients who've got multiple medical problems, age over 50, and then on the right-hand side are those with even more problems and, in fact, presenting with severe symptoms. And you can see the protocol. The most important part of the protocol is up top, povidone iodine, hydrogen peroxide, or even now xylitol, colloidal silver. There's a whole variety of nasal virucidal sprays and washes, spraying twice up each nostril, sniffing it back and spitting out, then gargle, a good 30-second gargle. Doing that every 4 to 6 hours is huge. That's the most important thing I've learned during the pandemic. Beyond that, we, in the OTC bundle, monoclonal antibodies used to be available. They're not currently available, to my knowledge, anywhere. So we move on to the anti-infective drugs. And across this, this is where people have spent the most time. And I think, again, it's a waste of time to spend so much effort on one single drug when it takes 4 to 6. But hydroxychloroquine, 380 studies, about 15 early treatment trials, about 25% treatment benefit. Ivermectin, 95 studies, 45 trials, about a 50% treatment benefit. Not all the trials agree. Some turn in neutral results. There's a recent neutral one in, I believe, JAMA. And then Paxlovid or molnupiravir. Recently, molnupiravir failed in a very large study, and so it's fallen off the algorithm. But Paxlovid has some supportive data in one trial. Another trial was stopped early, presumably for efficacy. And Paxlovid has over 40 drug interactions and has a CDC drug warning against it, but it's still viable in there. Azithromycin and doxycycline cover atypical organisms and bacterial overgrowth. If there's respiratory symptoms or day 5 of illness, we use corticosteroids. We can use inhaled budesonide throughout, then oral prednisone later on. We use oral colchicine throughout the illness. And then bedridden individuals get enoxaparin. So again, it's a multi-drug regimen. On the right, we can use oxygen concentrators and really care for people at home. The low oxygen saturation is probably one of the most manageable aspects of the illness. I've managed patients in the O2 sats in the 70s. As long as they have good mentation and good support system, they can do it. So there were so many panic hospitalizations, and paper from the VA by Fillmore and colleagues back in June of 2021 showed that 45% of the hospitalizations were just purely based on panic. There's no need for oxygen. Oxygen saturations were fine once they got to the hospital. So in the United States, we racked up about 10 million hospitalizations, a million deaths. And by my Senate testimony and the learning curve of how we learned how to do this, those numbers could have been reduced by 2/3. And so I think it's a real shame. One of the things we've learned, and this is a protocol I worked on with the Italians, does not use hydroxy or ivermectin, so uses other drugs substituting in. that the first 3 days, as shown, is the golden window of treatment. That if we get treatment started in the first 3 days, it's night and day. We absolutely positively cannot allow patients to get sick enough to go to the hospital. By that time, it's too late. By October of 2021, we had a home treatment guide that's been updated. If you ever wanted something to hand to patients from my office, go to aapsonline.org. And this is a wonderful home treatment guide. It's curated Frontline Critical Care Network, and Americans Frontline Doctors also have protocols. They're all good. This one is comes from a chartered established physician organization. Then lastly, the vaccines are not sufficiently safe or effective. And I know this will come as a disappointment to you. We know that 96% of doctors took the vaccine. The CDC says 87% of people overall in the United States took the vaccine. And when people took the vaccine, they took it based on faith, that the government on good faith was telling us that it was safe, that it was going to work, and that most of what we heard about the vaccines was aspirational. That is, we were hopeful they were going to work. But there's never really been a shot in the arm that stopped a respiratory pandemic. You know, treatment had a much better chance of getting things under control. But in prior pandemics, there have been no effective forms of treatment. And there's never been a vaccine that's been used to end a highly prevalent morbid pandemic. So in many ways, everything was a gamble. The vaccine's clearly a great gamble in human life. This is the Omicron waves. We're in the Omicron afterwave right now. But the point is, our predominant strains are BQ1 and BKA. BQ and XBB. Those are our predominant strains. We have nearly completely replaced the BA3A4, 3A5. And that's important to know, because if A4, A5 is out, then the bivalent boosters are obsolete at this point in time. A new mutation has come in. A paper by Clausen and colleagues from Harvard now has concluded that 94% of people have been through COVID. So I anticipate most of you have been through it, which is great news. It means you're going to do fine. Now, I said safety, and we always talk about safety before efficacy. In court order documents, it was revealed that Pfizer knew about 1,223 deaths within 90 days of release of their product in the mandatory post-marketing phase. Pfizer didn't shut down the program. The FDA didn't shut down the program. And I think, you know, all the people involved at Pfizer and the FDA are in big trouble on this. You can't let a new product stay on the market when people are dying shortly after taking it. So a causality assessment doesn't matter in this immediate post-marketing period. Patients do have to stay alive. It's just a criteria of being a new product. So by all conventional criteria, Pfizer should be off the market as we speak because of this. This is in the Public Health Professional Review Committee. The Daily Cloud's been reviewing these, but these are court-ordered Pfizer documents. World Council for Health has called for the vaccines to be removed from the market. This is a worldwide non-governmental organization in almost every state in the United States, so I think that's important. And we have data from these different data sets that in 2021 and 2022, when the vaccines rolled out, the reported deaths were astronomical, far more than any other database or any other medicine used in that run-up period to the era of the vaccines. And then the analyses on adverse events, you can see here, COVID-19 in purple for the Vigi Access Fairs and Ultravigilance. You can see here that in these databases that the total number of adverse events, and this is in the World Council for Health Pharmacovigilance Report, that the adverse events for the COVID-19 vaccine far exceed the tetanus vaccine, MMR, and the polio vaccine. And those are even more frequently used in aggregate than COVID-19 vaccine. So the adverse events we saw with COVID-19 vaccination are not a product of just more people getting vaccinated. It's that there's much greater toxicity with these vaccines. Now, recognizing probably most of you took one of the COVID vaccines, you wanted to get a benefit out of it. I believe there's been 4 false claims of the COVID-19 vaccine program. The first one was that the vaccines prevent infection. By May of 2021, there were so many breakthrough hospitalizations and deaths of the fully vaccinated. The CDC kept gave up keeping track of it. That once we got past the original Wuhan strain with different mutations, vaccine efficacy became negligible. The vaccines were found to only last 6 months. All of this basically was erosive on the vaccines ever stopping the infection. Our CDC director came out and said the vaccines don't stop transmission. And no randomized trial ever has shown a reduction in hospitalization and death with the vaccines compared to placebo when that's a primary or secondary outcome. And the only way to make a claim that the vaccines reduce hospitalization death is to show it in such a randomized trial. And then lastly, that the vaccines, I anticipate they're going to say is preventing outbreak reoccurrences. No data to support that at all. So despite, tens of thousands of manuscripts on COVID-19 vaccines, vast majority are observational, heavily biased by those who are advancing the vaccine agenda, and none of them can show a clinical benefit of taking a vaccine. What's going on is the vaccine manufacturers have railroaded products through the FDA while raking in massive amounts of pre-purchased revenue. And this has been a stunning development. The most recent boosters were released with no human testing. This is astonishing. What we know here is that just animal testing was done for the bivalent boosters, and the primary endpoint was a rise in antibodies, even though the animals got just as sick with the bivalent versus the traditional boosters. There have been 8 emergency use authorizations based on antibody rises. And even our U.S. FDA diagnostics division says that antibodies cannot be used to conclude that someone has immunity. What guarantees immunity is having a prior clinical infection of COVID and having that be well documented. So 8 EUAs based on a false surrogate endpoint. And our FDA diagnostics division says that antibodies are a false surrogate. So you can see the regulatory environment here has become completely unmoored. We're completely disconnected from medical jurisprudence, ethics in clinical trials, in with any type of sound judgment for our patients right now for the majority of doctors in practice. So to finish and conclude, we should end all lockdowns and restrictions. We should test only those on label and acutely ill patients, recognize prior infection in all the applications. You know, the military, NFL, Major League Baseball, they're still not keeping track of who previously had the infection. That's the most important variable. And then we should drop the vaccine mandates and pause all the current products that are on the market. So I'll stop here at this brief update and open it up to the floor for questions or comments.
So what does the future look like? What do you see in the next 6 months? What do you see in the next year? And how does this portend for medical, most of us are in the medical field. What does this look like going into the future with other issues?
Well, let me give you a couple more talking points that came in through survey data. Over the holidays, a survey was done by Rasmussen Reports, which is a sample survey company in the United States. And they asked questions, and what they found out is about 2/3 of people claim that they took the vaccines. 28% of them say they know somebody who's died of the vaccine, 28%, which is an astonishing number. Another paper came out from Michigan State, Mark Skidmore, using social science survey data. And there, again, about 2/3 of the country took a vaccine. And of those reporting back, shockingly, using all these various social networks where they, people talk to other people and know somebody who died, the aggregate estimate for the country in the first year of the pandemic was 278,000 Americans dying of the vaccine. Paper by Columbia, Pantazaptos, and Seligman using U.S. Census Vaccine Administration data, they came up with 187,000 Americans dying in the first year of the vaccine. If we just use the VAERS system, by December of 2021, at an underreporting ratio of 30, now some experts think it's 50, but even at 30 conservatively, that would put 240,000 Americans losing their lives in the first year of the pandemic. So these are astronomical numbers. They're way bigger than any war. The product should have been pulled off the market very early 2021 when the excess mortality signal was there. When Pfizer had their 90-day dossier, for sure they should have been taken off. Since that time, we've had over 1,200 peer-reviewed papers in the literature describing fatal and non-fatal vaccine injury syndrome. So this is not controversial. The myocarditis is fatal. The blood clots are fatal. Neurologic hemorrhages are fatal. And we're seeing large numbers of people die at this point in time. And it's almost certainly the vaccine, because the literature states that these syndromes are fatal. So I think we're looking at more all-cause death at this point in time. We're looking at a public who I don't think wants the vaccines. I think if the vaccines were dropped from the U.S. market, there wouldn't be any utilization of it. We've had wide open corruption and malfeasance of our public health agencies. And I think this is important to point out. After this, I've got a school of public health meeting to get on. And I can tell you that people in these schools of public health, their thought process is somewhat disturbed. They're not really clicking and making good eye contact and not acting like they understand the gravity of what's going on. Now, our CDC says 87% of Americans have taken one or more shots. The Rasmussen survey and the Skidmore survey also indicate it's only about two-thirds of people took a vaccine. So our CDC potentially could be overestimating things to try to gin up any remaining enthusiasm to take a vaccine. But it doesn't look good for the vaccine program at this point in time. The only theoretical worker group that could have made a difference was nursing home workers. And a recent analysis from the CDC shows that the workers in nursing homes are only 10% vaccinated, 10%, if there's any proxy. Yet at the same time, there's no nursing home mandates. The nursing home workers aren't taking it. At the same time, the CDC ACIP team has actually put the genetic vaccines into the routine pediatric schedule down to age 3 months. So we're seeing things here that don't make any sense. They appear to be wrong from a pharmacovigilance clinical trial perspective. And many of us would love to know where to go from here. So I think we're in for several more years of this. I don't see any capitulation by the administrations. We still have emergency use authorizations extended, emergencies extended. This has been a giant power grab by a small number of people in government.
Can you comment about the type of vaccine? I mean, why was this type of vaccine used as opposed to the more traditional ones? This was something new or novel, right?
Right. Now, worldwide, the most commonly used vaccine, I believe, is Sinovac or the CoronaVac vaccine. That's actually a Chinese vaccine. That's a killed virus vaccine. That would be far more traditional. There are some spike protein only vaccines, Corbevax and Novavax, but the real workhorse vaccines for most places are the genetic vaccines. Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson. And I think it was a giant mistake to go with these technologies. Most doctors asked no questions and they took it. But we've learned since that time they last in the body far longer than we ever thought. Spike protein even longer than the genetic material. And the FDA says these vaccines cause heart damage. They cause brain damage, neurologic damage. And this is the last thing we want to see a pregnant mother or a baby have.
I get your newsletter every day. You had something, I think it was in today's newsletter, that about something that kills the spike protein.
Yeah, an interesting development was published recently by Tanakawa and colleagues from Japan. And clinically, what most of us have done is we've tried to treat the consequences of the spike protein accumulation in tissues and organs. So we've used anti-inflammatories, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, prednisone, nutraceutical supplements. Nothing, in my view, nothing has worked. I've tried virtually everything. And a recent preclinical study by Tanikawa replicated a prior study by another scientist and then took it a step further. It was striking. Nattokinase, a natural substance derived by fermenting soybeans, was amazingly effective in clearing the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. The spike protein basically undergoes a digestive breakdown with this oral orally available enzyme. And so it is also a thrombolytic, so we have to have caveats for bleeding. There are no human randomized trials for use in SARS-CoV-2 recovered or vaccine patients. There are plenty of studies in cardiovascular patients, it appears safe. But I just don't think people are going to wait at this point in time. So, and a suggested empiric dose would be nattokinase 2,000 fibrinolytic units, FUs, every 12 hours. And I'm probably going to continue this, for 10 or 12 months in a year, see if we can't get this to completely resolve.
A question is anyone working on treating the ill effects of the vaccines, and what can be done to clear the debris, we'll put it, that's deposited in people's systems?
I'm unaware of any funding for vaccine injury syndromes at this point in time. Many in allopathic medicine refuse to even recognize vaccine injury syndromes, despite, how common they are and how frequently they're clearly associated with the syndrome. Patients are frustrated. They're seeking doctors who will recognize their vaccine injuries. And we're hopeful here, again, that nattokinase could could dissolve the spike protein or be degradative. We don't know what's going to happen to those fragments. There's some concern that the genetic fragments themselves could be gene could help clear the spike protein from the body. But we'll have to see. I think holistic and integrative doctors are going to be far more likely to bring forward answers than the allopathic community, because the allopathic community is going to wait for randomized trials, and they're simply not there.
Go back a little bit. When you started, with the history, when you said that, we were sort of mandated not to treat anything until the patients were severely ill. So I always go back to my mother had an eye problem, and she went and she had they were going to give her, I think, Lucentis. She had a macular degeneration, and they sent her for a chest X-ray, and she had stage 4 lung cancer with no symptoms in both lungs, and they told her she had 3 weeks to live. And they did, we didn't just tell her go home and die. I mean, we don't do that, normally unless it's hopeless. Why was it with this entity, we were told don't do anything. I mean, that's against everything. I've been a doctor for 40 years. That's everything that we've been told not to do.
It's true what you've said. It's a violation of the Hippocratic Oath. Remember, the Hippocratic Oath says, above all, do no harm. And then the next thing it says is do everything you can for your patients, offer compassionate care. The answer to this is this was practiced in the book COVID-19, The Global Predators, We Are the Prey by Peter Bregan. He outlined since 2012 36 pandemic preparedness planning events, 25 of which generated documents, 6 of which were filmed, like Event 201. In each case, they have a scenario, and they make certain that no early treatment is offered, and patients, in a sense, are in a fear-driven panic to take the vaccines later on. So we think it's intentional by the biopharmaceutical complex to drive mass vaccination.
Okay, so Dr. Good Kanadi asks, we all know that vaccines cause problems in many people. I've seen children with bad problems from MMR vaccines, which is also mandated, and also adolescents adults who suffer from Schoenfeld syndrome, autoimmune inflammatory disease. Are you working on reducing mandates on some of these?
Yeah, I think at this point in time, I think all the vaccines on the routine schedule need to be re-examined When I was a kid, I had three shots when I was, as a child. Now this is advanced over the course of a lifetime, at least to 18 years old, if we consider SARS-CoV-2 shots. I think the kids are nearly up to 100 shots. So from 3 to 100, it's far too many. It's an immunologic blitz on the body. And we're going to have to go through each and every one of them. So for instance, diphtheria and pertussis are easily treated with azithromycin. I mean, there'd be no reason to vaccinate for them anymore. For the measles and mumps outbreaks that have been reported, they tend to occur in the fully vaccinated individuals. So from measles mumps perspective, it's not very compelling. I think the one vaccine that's pretty compelling is rubella. Rubella, we used to have 20,000 cases of congenital rubella per year, and that's down to basically zero cases. That one was pretty impressive. It's a shot in the arm, works against a respiratory virus. I think rubella is solid. Polio, I can't tell, because water sanitation had such a big impact in polio, but at the same time that was being done was a completion of approaches with the vaccine. So I think polio is reasonably well supported. Lots of controversy as we move forward. Gardasil vaccine, et cetera. You know, it's too much to review them all right now, but I think the entire schedule needs to be reviewed. A recent Kaiser survey suggests about a third of adults right now who are small children are considering going natural with no vaccines.
I know, back in the 80s, I was delivering babies, and then we did family practice, and we were their doctors also. And they kept adding more vaccines, and these kids were getting seizures, and they were getting, all sorts of neurological issues. And then they would pull them off 3 months later. They would tell us, you have to give these vaccines. Rotavirus was one that I remember. And 3 months later, it was pulled off. And I finally said, I'm not doing it anymore. This is just ridiculous. We got the first polio vaccines. That's our generation. Those, were studied for a million years before they released, and those work. So, question, and this actually, there was a news article yesterday about a doctor down in Las Vegas who was being sued now because she prescribed, I think it was either hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, and 3-4 months later, the patient passed away. I don't have all the details. What are your recommendations if we start getting some heat for prescribing these things?
It depends on the era of time. If it was the era of time before Paxlovid, hydroxychloroquine could be viewed as a reasonable community standard of care, and as long as the doctor understood the risks and benefits of hydroxychloroquine and fairly inform the patient, then, I think they're fine. Same thing with ivermectin, probably in the second year of the pandemic in 2022. Both hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin are far safer than Paxlovid. So if one is trying to argue that they should have had an EUA approved drug, the safety profile is not as well characterized or as favorable with.
I don't know all the details. Apparently, this person was referred online through the FLCC, the frontline doctors, and it was a female. She prescribed, I think it was hydroxychloroquine. It was in the summer of 2020, I think, and in 2021 in January, I guess this guy had a heart attack, he didn't wake up one day, and then they're blaming her. Well, and again, it was a newspaper article like that. I don't know all the details, but
We use long-term hydroxychloroquine for lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. Even if this patient was on long-term hydroxychloroquine, it does cause QT prolongation, but it's a very steady and fixed QT prolongation. So it's typically not the hydroxy that's the problem. It's some additional drug that's added in temporarily.
Okay. And So the question is, we start getting heat from the, authorities and whatnot. What's your recommendation?
Well, we need to have good panels of experts for each other. I think the key is community standard of care. And I think, I testified in the Texas Senate in March of June of 2022. And I said, listen, the community standard of care evolved from practicing doctors. Community care standard of care never comes from federal public health agencies, doesn't come from medical boards or from hospitals or clinics. It actually comes from the practicing doctors. So I think good experts that can articulate that, that hydroxychloroquine was the community standard of care at the time, in addition to other drugs, that, you know, reasonable efforts were made if the patient received fair informed consent. It sounds like this may have happened actually many months after even having COVID. So it even becomes
that's the way I read it too, but it was a news article somewhere. Dr. Gerber asks about nicotine for long COVID.
You know, nicotine for long COVID in low dose naltrexone for symptoms have been proposed. I don't have any experience with either one of those. So I want to learn from others on this. Patients with long COVID are miserable. We know about 50% of people get it who are sick enough to be hospitalized. The good news with long COVID is that it always gets better. The natural history is it will resolve.
In my limited experience, we've used methylene blue and low-dose naltrexone with some efficacy. But again, that was kind of anecdotal. I don't have any studies for it, but that's what we've used. What is your opinion about gargle and drink CISTUST and propolis? I guess that's bee pollen spray.
I don't know about the substances, but I can tell you that there are now proven randomized trials with dilute povidone iodine, dilute hydrogen peroxide, xylitol, which is in the clear formulation, colloidal silver. The virus is very easily killed in the nose. Even dilute baby shampoo works, to be honest with you. So in the McCullough protocol, we advise the most important part is the nasal virucidal washes. If I had my druthers, it'd be, you know, 1% povidone iodine. So 10 drops of povidone iodine in a nasal spray bottle, pinch of salt, mix it up, and then spray it up each nostril twice, sniff it back and spit it out, and then gargle with the same solution for a 30-second gargle. This can be done every 4 to 6 hours when sick. I think it's more effective than anything else. And when we take pills, they don't penetrate the sinuses. We have to knock down the viral load in the sinuses so the body is not overwhelmed with infection.
Can you repeat that formulation? I know our resident compounding pharmacist is on here. So
I would take a 10% povidone iodine solution, which is a brown bottle of betadine, and it's about 10 drops, no more than half a teaspoon, in a standard spray bottle, which is, I believe, 1.5 ounces. And then just a pinch of salt, mix it up. The same thing of that quantity for a gargle. And 1.5 ounces, by the way, is a shot glass. And so that gives you a handy reference. When you're using povidone iodine, it should be as the consistency of light tea. If you're using any sprays in the nose and the mouth that sting or hurt, they're too strong. The mistake people make is they make things too strong. And I think the mistake they make is they make too big of a volume. You can just use a few drops each time. That $5 bottle of betadine is going to last a long time.
What are your latest protocols on ivermectin?
Ivermectin, using it in acute treatment, 600 micrograms per kilogram, typically for 5 days. Do not hesitate to extend out to 30 days if needed. Some are using it in long COVID syndromes. I am not. And some use it in vaccine injury syndromes. I am not. I think the big breakthrough with ivermectin is the availability of online pharmacy. So I don't know too many doctors that prescribe it anymore. They can simply buy it online and get, decent quality ivermectin. One of the lead suppliers in the United States is called Reliable Rx, and you'll find that they have the ivermectin 12 milligram capsules, which is real handy.
Okay. And I don't know what this is, an opinion on Baikalin, Baikalin. I'm not sure what that is.
No, I don't know about it.
Okay. Can you speak to the lesions identified on autopsies and brought to light in the documentary Died Suddenly?
There are now two autopsy studies to quote, one by Schwab and the other one by Chavez. They looked at people who died after the vaccine within about a 20, 30-day window. They found dead at home. People just found dead at home. This should be very alarming to anybody, but you know, they came up with, you know, decent sample sizes where this happened. Both studies agree 70 to 80% of people who die within a month of the vaccine, they have a vaccine injury syndrome that's clearly identified in pathology. Fatal myocarditis, heart failure, progressive atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, Guillain-Barré syndrome, of intracranial hemorrhage, a deep venous thrombosis. 70 to 80% of the deaths are due to the vaccine.
So Dr. Marsh is one of our resident gastroenterologists, and he states he saw time after time gross negligence with intended destruction of people. He listed many reasons as to the errors that were along the way. And the bottom line of this question is there any effort to hold anybody who knew that these were not legitimate accountable?
There's been many attempts to try to bring people to justice. We're starting to see some Senate investigations, some House investigations. Crimes against humanity cases so far haven't gone anywhere. There just seems to be widespread corruption in the courts and the public health agencies. And we may be a long time before we get into, you know, fair justice, but people should be brought to justice. We should have never suffered like this as a nation. All the aspects of pandemic response by the public health agencies was wrong. Social distancing, masking, shutting down schools. In fact, the alternatives should have been followed. The Great Barrington Declaration, keeping the schools open, should have been followed. McCullough Protocol and AAPS home guide should have been followed. So all these things were available by October of 2020. And because our government not only did not pick them up, but actually worked actively against them, in my view, our government is culpable of a large loss of life and unnecessary hospitalization.
So what was your life like before COVID? Can you remember that?
I barely can remember it. It was an enjoyable academic career. I had focused on heart and kidney disease. I was the most published person in my field in the world in history. I led the B-type metrioric peptide multinational study that really changed the diagnosis of heart failure and published it in the New England Journal of Medicine, Circulation, and JACC all at the same time in a late-breaking ACC abstract. I had over 650 peer-reviewed publications as editor of my own textbook, editor of two major journals, had professorships, traveled the world. Since COVID, because I treated patients and published on how to do it, and because I have commented on vaccine safety and published on it, I have been stripped of everything I've just told you. And the stripping occurs either by email or by certified letter with no courtesy phone call, no due process, and no explanation.
We at least got a courtesy phone call on ours. So these are just some comments. Polio was probably a DDT poisoning. That's Dr.
Yes.
Chandler.
Yes. But no, that is a leading theory. That polio, in fact, wasn't a neurotropic injury, but had to do with insecticide poisoning. So I'm aware of that. And also, you know, eradication of polio may have been incorrectly attributed to the vaccine, and it should be more better attributed to better sanitations. So those are correct statements.
Another statement, Dr. Cooley, I believe 18 vaccines by age one per the CDC.
Okay.
Sounds about right. Dr. Beverly, I'm just going to say I can't pronounce her last name properly. High dose vitamin C intravenous with other supplements has worked well for her patients. So any comment on
vitamin C? Comment. I don't have a lot of experience with IV vitamin C, but I've recently spent some time with Dr. Pio Corey and Paul Merrick who do. The supportive data are there. I think the trick with vitamin C is that it doesn't have a very durable effect in the bloodstream. So whether taken oral or IV, you have to administer it pretty frequently. But I've recently tried this with some upper respiratory tract conditions. You just can't be afraid of using a lot of it. And so the overall gram dosages of vitamin C get up there, but the body readily excretes it, and it does have antiviral properties at these higher and frequent dosing.
Okay. So Dr. Lewis has one person vaccinated in his program had a severe Herxheimer reaction. They were on methylene blue infusion, while others without the injection did not. So without the vaccine. So.
Yeah, well, methylene blue, I know this group has a lot of experience with it. It may hold a lot of promise for these vaccine injury syndromes. There's clearly a vascular aspect to these vaccine injury syndromes. I published from my lab with Zhang and all early on that the spike protein was going to be damaging to the blood vessels, causing micro blood clots, causing all kinds of dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system, large blood vessels. So there really could be a role. I've used most of the traditional drugs. I haven't found a benefit of hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, fluvoxamine. I've tried them. I think there are certain syndromes where they do play a role in vaccine injuries. So I'm looking for strategies, nanokinase being one. I'm going to take a careful look at bromelain and acetylcysteine. Methylene blue, this group has advanced this considerably. I think it's going to be holistic and naturopathic doctors that are going to lead us out of this. It doesn't look like it's coming from allopathic medicine.
We've been looking at oxytocin also, nasal spray. That's another one. Are there any safe vaccines? I think you sort of touched on that before.
So. No, I mean, I had recently had this on my podcast that I thought the safest in the United States was Novavax. Now there's been a whole dossier of Novavax deaths and injuries that's occurred worldwide. So I just don't think we're safe there. I mean, if I had a gun put to my head right now and I had to take a vaccine to live on Earth, I would take Novavax. I wouldn't expect any benefit from it. But at least Novavax is not a genetic vaccine.
I have a question here. I'll ask it. I don't think you think there will be criminal indictments.
I think this is going to be like Enron or one of these big disasters. I think in the end, everyone's going to get off scot-free here. There's not enough anger in the population right now. The population still seems to be in a trance, and young people are not activated. There's 1,000 colleges with college mandates. And the students don't seem to mind, but we don't see much in the way of student protest. Some of these colleges, there's no vaccine for the faculty, but the students have to take it. And they are. And the universities aren't showing any remorse if there's myocarditis, blood clots, or death. But the families of the children don't seem to be outraged either. So people just seem to be in a trance at this point in time. And I think until we're going to have to get to, in the Vietnam War, I think over the course of nearly a decade, it was 59,000 deaths. First year of the pandemic now, good estimates, 250,000 Americans lost their lives with the vaccine, 250,000. And outside of a few doctors like myself and you and others, no one seems to be ringing the alarm bells.
Okay. Do you have any recommendations for treating damage caused by remdesivir?
Remdesivir seems to cause acute kidney injury. That's the biggest thing we worry about. I don't think it's recoverable, but I do tell people who've gotten remdesivir in the hospital, for sure, get an outpatient creatinine. I also get a cysteine protease inhibitor filtration test called cystatin C and a urine albumin to creatinine ratio. You want to reassess where someone is. It's really largely those who had pre-existing kidney disease that got into trouble with remdesivir.
Any insight into COVID or COVID vaccine risks from things like Jakob Creutzfeldt disease?
Yeah, recently published on this with Stephanie Senoff from MIT that there's no doubt about it that the spike protein is neurotoxic, mediated through toll-like receptor 4, MAP kinases, and that the spike protein folds. It's amyloidogenic and it's clearly been found in the brain at autopsy. I'm greatly worried that those who are predisposed to cognitive decline or Alzheimer's may have an accelerated course. It's just there's too much lining up here for that hypothesis not to to become fully mature. Oh, by the way, on my Substack recently, there was a paper from Croatia. And there are some people who are susceptible. They take the vaccines and they actually develop a wide open psychosis, they become completely psychotic, have to sometimes try to commit suicide, have to be hospitalized, need multiple drugs. Again, having a susceptible person and just the right characteristics. People ask, why do some people have these various syndromes and others don't? Marc Giardot in France, who's analyzed this, has suggested that, you know, the nurses don't pull back the plunger on the injection. So about 2.5% of people must get an intravascular injection of the material. That's the estimate. That's actually been studied in the past. And then the other thing is there's a striking lot-to-lot variability. This has come up in CDC analyses and also in Pfizer and Moderna. The estimates are 80% of the deaths with Pfizer from 30% of the lots, 80% of the deaths with Moderna and 20% of the lots. That means that some lots must have a lot of genetic material. Some lots must have a small amount of material. It doesn't look like it's going to be a contaminant there. None of the vaccines by EUA undergo inspection. That's the reason why we don't know how much genetic material is in each vial. No inspections allowed under EUA.
There are a number of comments thanking you and all your colleagues for willing to speak up and support true and free choices in healthcare. I have a half a dozen at least comments in here. How do you explain the extremely low incidence of flu and other communicable diseases when the mask and social distancing was taking place?
I think what happened is people came in with flu and they tested positive for COVID. There's a paper by Clausen and colleagues shows 94% of Americans are already through COVID. So once somebody's through COVID, they'll test intermittently positive for 6 months or more. So I think there's people who really had COVID in July and they come in December with the flu. They test positive for COVID. They never get a concomitant flu test. And they're misdiagnosed as COVID. I think this is happening over and over again. The hospitals are financially incentivized to diagnose COVID. They're not financially incentivized to diagnose influenza. So I encourage all my patients to get both an influenza test and a COVID test. Get both of them so we don't get fooled on this issue. But I think the short answer is I think flu patients were misdiagnosed as having COVID.
Dr. Crowley says keep your efforts going. Any thoughts on becoming running for office anywhere?
This whole political process has been so brutal just to even, you know, be a speaker at various events. I would entertain an appointed position if it came my way. I feel like I've done 3 years of public service. I could almost finish out my career doing this. I've been fired from two practice jobs now in Dallas for officially no reason, despite being very financially favorable to both practices. So, now I'm in the process of moving my practice out of Dallas to a suburb, and I'm going completely cash practice. And I'm overwhelmed with patients, honestly, calling for an appointment. So
if you want to come to Reno, Nevada, you're more than welcome. We'll take you in. We'll take you in anytime.
That's my daughter's in Reno right now for a business meeting. So it's funny. She just landed there.
Well, tell her to give me a call. We'll take good care of her. We'll make sure she knows where to go after hours. So, Dr. Stockton states that she's also interested in Jakob Creutzfeldt disease. She had a friend die two weeks ago. Never had COVID, but had the vaccine and boosters. So, again.
Let me just comment that it's not only the initial production of the spike protein. There's a recent paper showing that the messenger RNA now circulates in the body, proven for 30 days. It's been stuck in lymph nodes for months. There must be a long period of time of production of spike protein. And if it does incorporate into DNA, and in fact it is expressed or inducible, the body could be in the business of making spike protein for a long period of time. That occurring in the brain is going to be a disaster. It looks like the human brain cannot tolerate this spike protein at all. There's almost no clearance mechanisms for it. So the spike protein to act like a prion, like Jakob Creutzfeldt illness, is I think very tractable.
Any information on chlorine dioxide, getting help in getting rid of COVID long haul and ridding the spike protein due to the vaccine?
Yeah, I imagine people on this call are more expert than myself, but I've taken an interest in chlorine dioxide because, you know, it's used to purify water to go camping. So it must be safe for that. I'm stunned to see the warnings on the Mayo Clinic website that admonish anybody for ever considering chlorine dioxide as in any type of medicinal application. But I've been particularly impressed with elderly patients with recurrent UTIs and multiple antibiotics. Chlorine dioxide is a method of, it's actually, you know, it's drinking water that's using this purification method. The water quickly goes into the bladder, and it makes sense that an antimicrobial agent is going to make an impact there. It's probably almost certainly antiviral. But like so many things in the pandemic, chlorine dioxide needed adequate study, and it didn't get it.
Okay. Our other Dr. Marsh, who's a fertility expert, says that she's seen a lot of miscarriages in women with cycle disorders, those requiring progesterone or needing more and having to support to 37 weeks on a lot more women. So.
Yeah, quick comment there. British Medical Journal, large study. There's no doubt about it. I think it's 16,000 women. Large study. The vaccines clearly disturb menstrual cycles. I mean, that's now well agreed upon. Average cycle is extended for about a day. So because of the various forms of the ovulatory cycle and then ultimately settling into the uterus, that just changing the cycle alone will drop fertility, female fertility, for sure, 100% for sure. Then we have more disturbing maternal fetal outcomes. Thorpe and colleagues has a series of publications.
Is he going?
He's muted.
You're muted.
Sorry about that. There's a Thorpe and colleagues have published. There's about a tenfold increased rate of fetal loss in the first trimester, stillbirth after 20 weeks, hemorrhagic fetal death afterwards, placental hemorrhage and clots. And this is runs counter to dozens of papers in the literature that declare that the vaccines are safe in pregnancy. And I've analyzed these papers carefully. Most of the papers actually have zero follow-up. They're not even collecting any maternal fetal outcomes to report on. So they're simply reporting that women are pregnant, take the vaccine, and nothing happens because they're not collecting any information that could possibly be utilized as a safety event. So I think we have a fraudulent literature out there, and this is probably driven through ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. ACOG took an undisclosed amount of money from the Biden White House and HHS in the COVID Community Core program. That was about $13 billion. We don't know how much went to ACOG, but I think the association here is completely biased, these doctors who have pushed the vaccines without any assurances on short or long-term safety.
Okay, Dr. McCullough, I see that you have, thank you very much for this presentation. We appreciate everything you're doing in the fight for straighten up all this mess that we have in medicine. But I see that you have dry cough, and last Monday we talked about, actually yesterday, we talked about mast cell activation syndrome as the main problem of post-COVID-19 syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And there's pathology for that. And I see that you are having dry cough, so I was just wondering, you may need Benadryl, because my wife, she went to the hospital. This is the first time I see a hospital is open mind, and they give her IV Benadryl.
It's interesting you mentioned that. You know, in acute COVID, I developed some experience based on collaboration with Dr. Eugenia Brentios from El Salvador and Dr. Sankarit Chetty from South Africa, they feature the use of cyproheptadine, slightly different antihistamine than diphenhydramine. But histamines do play a role for sure. The mast cells and basophils are probably, honestly, far more activated and easily triggered with spike protein expression in viral invasion. For POTS, posterior orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, which is common after COVID and certainly common after the vaccines, you know, my experience there from a cardiologist, we do a workup. We typically don't find much. But you know, it's a real syndrome. The one thing I found in probably about half the cases is you will find a genetic defect in one of the structural collagens that's involved in the aorta, or sometimes related as a variant of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or Lowy Dietz or what have you. So I do in vitae genetic testing in the POTS patients just because I want to know if they're going to have a long-term problem or not. For the tachycardia and the variable blood pressure, my go-to drug, and it's just my opinion, I've managed, gosh, hundreds of these, is actually Nadolol. It's a beta blocker that has some intrinsic sympathomimetic activity, so it doesn't really completely beta block down. The younger patients don't tolerate the metoprolol and atenolol, some of the straight beta blockers, but the Nadolol seems to almost every time I've been gratified with a good response. It's one of the few clinical victories I've had in the vaccine injury space.
Dr. Lewis states or asks about activating methylene blue with red light therapy. Have you had any experience with that at all?
No, I saw a demonstration of that when I went to Bahamas, and I met with a doctor there who had been an innovator, methylene blue, and then an infrared light that actually goes in the mouth. It's like a probe, and it goes in the mouth. And I was fairly impressed, but I think Dr. Halassa, other people have more experience. I've never done it clinically myself, but what, if anything, I've learned out of this is I think the nasal and oral mucosal, the immunity, the virucidal approaches, I think that's where it's at, and it's going to work for COVID, RSV, flu, and other illnesses. This idea of letting the sinuses go crazy with hypersecretion and stuffiness and fever and sinus pain and loss of taste and smell, that is a giant mistake. We have to get going early in the oropharynx and nasopharynx.
So we found a lot of fungal overgrowth in the sinuses also. You know, these patients have had 3, 4, 5, 6 courses of antibiotics, and some of them are diabetic, and you know, they just, you know, the antibiotics clear them up for 2 weeks, and then it's right back again. And we find that there's fungal component to that also.
So does the methylene blue in the infrared, does it have enough penetration to make an impact there? Or
apparently it does, yeah.
Okay.
So somebody's asking the name and number of your attorney. I don't know if you want to reveal that. Yeah,
listen, I'm working with over 100 attorneys as an expert. I do it all pro bono. And then I have 12 cases where I'm a defendant or a plaintiff. And honestly, I've just been dissatisfied. And I'm not sure if it's the attorneys or just that the courts are corrupt. There just doesn't appear to be any justice right now. It's open season on doctors. And, you know, prior to COVID, I'm the most published person in my field in world and history. I have a spotless clinical track record. I had no problems with the medical boards. I was widely accepted in the medical community. And I haven't changed. I'm still the same person. I tweeted today about Dr. Scott Jensen in Minnesota, family doctor. He was a state senator for a period of time. The medical board is going after him for yet a fifth time for non-clinical reasons. The American Board of Internal Medicine is attempting to strip me of my medicine and cardiology boards for non-clinical reasons. So it appears to be an open season a political attack on doctors.
That was the next question, actually. Did you get your internal medicine board certification back? That's the next question.
Well, you know, there was a review committee. They didn't let me attend the meeting. They didn't review any of the materials that I gave them to support my Senate testimony, and they decided to strip me of my boards. Despite, you know, I'm in the maintenance and certification program, so I've taken the boards multiple times for medicine and cardiology. So I appealed, and I had to get attorneys to appeal. So now, you know, my penalties begin with the attorney appeal, and now my appeal date has been tabled indefinitely. So I don't know if that's a victory or not. I'm still certified to this day, although I've had inquiries now from insurance companies, and I've lost my second job during this ABIM fiasco. So if the goal was to injure me and the ABIM intended to injure me, then they've succeeded in doing that.
Our so-called hearing on our certification for our group, it sounds exactly the same. It was a kangaroo court. It was done ahead of time.
I think there's a big pharma behind this. There's some funding of Pfizer, a big thing, money-driven. You're fighting against billionaires and big pharma money. That's what I can see it.
Well, to support your conjecture, in our research, the American Board of Internal Medicine was colluding with Weber Shandwick, which is the PR and marketing firm for Moderna. And the CEO of ABIM was on a symposium ticket with Aliyah Mohsen, who's the vice president of digital health for Weber Shandwick, and then Blackbird AI and artificial intelligence. And the title of their topic was When Doctors Prescribe Misinformation. So we have prima facie evidence the American Board of Internal Medicine is working with the PR firm of Pfizer, Moderna. And to make matters worse, Weber Shandwick had an installed marketing unit within the CDC. Within the CDC, in fact, the CDC paid them $50 million. And Rand Paul was outraged. He sent a letter to Walensky. He said, "You can't." I was always wondering, why did the CDC, why do they push messenger RNA over the other forms of vaccines? Now I know the CDC is in bed with Pfizer and Moderna, officially in the offices in Atlanta.
Okay. How much more time do we have with you? I got 26 more questions.
So. Oh my gosh. Let's take one more, you guys, because I have to get off and prepare for the next one. Okay.
Let's look at this one. Mast cell activation syndrome is now recognized as the main pathophysiology of post-COVID due to the spike proteins inhibiting ACE2 and bradykinin breakdowns. Mm-hmm. Where's the question here?
We had covered that. I think there is a role, and there was a suggestion about, you know, considering antihistamines, which is pretty, and certainly asking questions. Patients will certainly tell you that they've had forms of urticaria, they've had forms of rashes. Remember, with mast cell deactivation, there's intermittent abdominal pain, cramping, you know, a whole constellation of symptoms. So,
the question: are you taking donations to support your work?
Yeah, if you go to my website, petermcculloughmd.com, there is a donate button. People have been amazingly generous, and I'm so grateful for it. It's been an odyssey. I got into this business to help people, and as a public figure, I've tried to help as many people as I can. I get hundreds and hundreds of messages. I try to help. I get curbsided all the time. Well, you know, we're going to have to let that be the last one. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Hopefully we'll get you again with 6 months to a year.
Yeah, hopefully we'll do it live.
There's many kudos and God bless yous, and thank you so much for your work.
Okay.
Can we add something here? Doctor, you have something live you're going to have it, right? Doctor William Bill? I mean, Dr. McCullough would be a great opportunity for you to get the live going.
Yeah, Bill, are you going to have any more live meetings, or did your decertification wipe out that?
Well, it kind of put a damper on it, but we're thinking about doing the end of the summer, beginning of the fall. We're probably going to have one. So, but the irony is that we're still certified by the AMA, just not the AOA. So go figure that.
There's a lot of health freedom meetings out there that organizers are already getting the venues and whatever. I bet you could identify one of them and just say, listen, can we have a doctor's meeting as an adjunct? And they'd be very happy to. It'd really defray a lot of the costs. And
We have some resources. Like you, I felt I've been a little bit beat up. So, organizing those meetings is quite arduous.
I know.
So I've sort of been taking a little bit of a break, but we've still been doing these. So.
Okay. All right. You guys are doing great work. I love all of you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay. Anybody have any comments, questions? Dr. Farshian, I see you're here. Do you have anything to add? Do you want to put a plug in for your conference coming up in June? John, are you here?
Everything's 100%.
Yes, I would love that. Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to very briefly talk about our upcoming meeting in month of June 2nd to 4th. It's a workshop. There's going to be cadaver parts. So basically the emphasis is learning procedures and injection techniques, mostly directed towards neurodegenerative diseases, as well as arthritis. Dr. Hall is going to be there. I believe he's the head of the American College of Prolotherapy, or the acting director. Dr. Purita is going to be there. He's going to have his techniques on orthopedic regenerative medicine. There is going to be, injection techniques, SPG, sphenoid-palatine ganglion. There's going to be talk on stem cells, exosomes, and our efforts is going to be board examination. Any of you who wants to get board certified by American Academy of Stem Cell Physicians, it's additive credibility, basically, because it's a test that's written by Dr. Purita, and you got to study for it, and then there's an oral test afterwards that is once you pass the written test. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about our upcoming program on June 2nd.
You left out the most important participant. Claudia's got me coming there too.
That's great. And you were just talking about joining hands, and this can be a great opportunity. And what we did was we found a place. This one is going to be in a hotel, but the next one after that, we found a place that is going to be in a surgical center that they use for teaching purposes to medical students. So it's really great fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dr. Clearfield.
Yes.
Stefan invited me into this meeting. I just did a webinar on his channel last week. One thing I think is a great hope we have coming in the future, a colleague of mine, an investment banker out of New York, has been working 15 years to develop a real health insurance platform. And, the train has left the station, according to all the members that are working hard on this. But I think it's something that your organization might be interested in, because they're actually interested in understanding risk and paying doctors quickly and paying doctors that are doing the right thing. And it's just like us working in the freedom space and creating an alternative health system and in our little microcosm. But if we can get paid for this, then we have a fighting chance. So I'll talk to Stefan about it, and I can certainly get one or more principal to come on and talk on your series.
Is that the group with Dr. Jackson from Michigan?
No, it's a group out of New Jersey and Texas.
Okay.
Dolphin is their new name, but they really have designed an excellent competitive system. Pat DeLeo, the CEO, since I've known him for about 8 years, said my mission in the rest of my life is to take down the Bukas.
Okay. If you get me a contact, we'll invite
I'll get it through Stefan. Yeah.
somebody knows how to save the messages in chat, because I don't. I can write to Dr. McCullough and see if he can answer the rest of the questions that we
need. When you save the when you quit the Zoom, and the file that's created also has the chat in it.
Okay. All right.
And I'll save it also.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else have any comments or questions? John, how you feeling, John?
Everything's great and all's good. Thank you very much.
I had a comment, if I might.
Sure. Who's speaking?
So this, my name's Beverly, Good. You can just call me Beverly. And I've been at this for, 28 years in integrative medicine, and I graduated med school in 1979. So yeah, that's how old I am. But I remember it's got to be about 25 years ago, Jonathan Wright, and I don't know if any of y'all have heard of Jonathan, but he wrote a number of books on holistic medicine, integrative medicine, back in the 80s. And he was the victim of what they called the Great Vitamin B Bust. And the government went in with guns into his office, I mean, fully loaded, and they took his computers and his files, and they went through everything, and then they came back finally and said the only thing he'd done wrong was he'd imported some vitamin B from Germany that he wasn't supposed to have. So this kind of, doing something different outside the mainstream has been going on for a really long time. I remember contributing to his defense fund way back then. So it's just, this is like not new. I'm not saying it's not bad. It's not difficult, but it's not new. When you speak truth to power, it doesn't go easy. It doesn't go easily.
I'll leave that to you, John. You have experience with that.
And she's got a bullseye there, and what she's talking about is extremely important, because it's not just one or two. It's probably thousands of doctors who have been affected by this, abused by this, suppressed, some wiped out and dead now. So we should at least have some type of discussion to help protect doctors who speak the truth. Our golden faux pas last year is having a panel discussion on ethics. We were told it was not allowed. And since we have another whole world going on. So, Beverly, if you can think of anything good we can do, we'll do it.
I forgot about the ethics.
The idea that we had before, if you remember, the autonomy of physician, me and you and your wife putting it together, I think that's the best thing to do, because then we can have a firm of lawyers specialized to defend physicians like this cases, and they are ready and they are equipped and they have all the information, because the lawyers out there, if they don't have the medical background, it's going to be difficult for them to understand what's right, what's wrong. But if we have that kind of team and a group of mix of doctors and lawyers and a firm and organization, that will be kind of a first call for all the doctors who are getting into this little all those problems that we are experiencing, seeing it.
The finest doctors we have today, the most ethical, open, and brilliant, are the ones who are being targeted. So we have to have some type of common sense reaction to this. And I'm a peace freak. I'm not calling for anything dangerous, but please stop attacking people like Dr. McCullough for no reason. So we know what's going on. Yes, it has been going on for 50 years, and we're doing our best. We're going to do more.
So you remember when they decertified us, they told us we could still come to OMED, their big conference in October, and then in August they sent me a cease and desist letter, and they uninvited us, and they stated we were hostile to the AOA, and my answer was, well, you were hostile first. They were hostile to us. We weren't hostile to them.
It's open and shut what's going on, but I think we do need to shine a light upon it, and I think we have ways of doing that. So we'll see in the next few months.
What about creating a medical defense fund and lining up with frontline doctors and AFLC and other like-minded physicians, and everybody donates to one medical defense fund. So when one of us is in trouble, there's a pot of money that can be used, you know, quickly to advocate for us, because the number of physicians that are being attacked, I mean, Jonathan Wright deserves tons of credit, but at that time, there weren't as many doctors being attacked for being mavericks. And now, I mean, you hear about a doctor getting in trouble for prescribing ivermectin almost every month. And so, you know, if all of us donated a reasonable amount, and, you know, or we could just say, donate however much you feel called to donate, and then we'd have to have, you know, some oversight over that money. But I think we would all feel more protected. And, you know, with your connections, Dr. Halas's connections, we could tap into some of the best law firms. You know, Dr. McCullough's lawyer is probably a good resource too. But I think that we're at a point where we need money to defend ourselves should we be attacked. And I think we should explore that and, you know, pray about it and think about a way to make that viable.
I got an idea. 1 hour before our next week's meeting, could we have another meeting directed toward doctors' defense? We'll spend about 30 minutes talking about it, come up with some ideas, sign off, and then let the regular show go on. But then we can present what we find. We'll have we can have a half hour to talk about it. We just do a Zoom at, whatever, 8 o'clock is our time. It'll be 7. So we do a Zoom and we'll talk about doctors' defense. And I'm a good guy to talk to because they just wiped me out, bankrupted me, took everything, and left the patients in our community to die.
God.
So if we want to get talking serious about this, we can do that.
We already have that program, supposedly me and you and Dr. Cruz, Sylvia. We already have this physician autonomy. It was in the process of finalizing it, but just we got a little bit lazy and behind. And then you moved to Hawaii, and I got a little bit lagged behind, traveled to Libya. But if you are serious, if there's physicians who are serious on this, right, we already have the structure. We have a very nice PowerPoint presentation from Dr. Cruz Sylvia, which is your wife. And we'll we can present that.
We'll talk about it next week.
All right. Sound great.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm out. Yeah. Thanks.
Good night, John.
Good night.
Take care. Next week we have Dr. John Newstead again. He had spoken to us on fracturing proof your bones. Not quite as exciting as this, but still interesting. So we'll be seeing him next week. And anybody else have any comments or questions? I'll try and record all of the questions that we didn't get to and send them to Dr. McCullough. Hopefully he'll send us any. And we'll talk about that whenever. So anybody else have any comments, questions?
No.
Complaints?
Comment in case, you know, I wasn't at the next meeting. Thomas Renz is an attorney from Cincinnati who has taken down multiple hospitals. I think he was involved in taking down a hospital in Illinois, and they settled for $10 million with their employees. And he's a guy that is going after everybody. And I haven't spoken to him. But there's another lawyer that I have spoken to who works closely with FLCC. He's out of New Jersey. And I think, you know, Dr. Halas's lawyer is great, but I think we need to tap into other, you know, bigger players that have more visibility and are fighting, you know, CDC, and they have access to whistleblowers from the CDC and things like that. So Thomas Renz Law is somebody that, if you all have time, look at his website, look at some of his speeches, look at some of the people that he's taken down. And I think we need a pool of attorneys and law firms, not just one firm. Maybe that's too ambitious, but, you know, just food for thought. And I'm going to sign off. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much. Anybody who's new, who joined, you know, found us, you know, by accident. If you're interested in our programs, please send me your email address, and we'll make sure that you get the notice on our programs. We are here every Tuesday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. 8 p.m. Eastern. So we're, you know, we're here every week. We've been here for 2.5 years. And you can, I'm going to leave you my, email address right here. It's in the chat, drbill9@gmail.com. If you want to, send me your email address, that's fine. I promise it won't get out anywhere. We'll add you to our mailing list. And anybody who has anything that they'd like to present, please let me know. So thank you, Dr. Drake. Email. Okay. So like I said, next week we're going to have Dr. Neustadt. He's also a naturopath. We've had him before. He was extremely interesting. Thank you all for coming. This was probably our biggest crowd. Dr. McCullough, of course, is quite an icon. You know, and there's you know, always a controversy about him there. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, the new folks. Thank you for coming. And we look forward to seeing you again. This week I'm going to be in Phoenix. I'm presenting at the facilitated microcurrent lecture. We're doing our traumatic brain injury program for them. AMMG at the April 27th to 30th. I'll be there. I'm doing 3 lectures. I'm doing the new face of weight loss. And they gave me 45 minutes to do thyroid and cortisol. And then 30 minutes to do a case presentation. So it's a little silly, I think. Dr. Farshian's conference in June. We're still working on that, and we're going to look to get together at the end of the summer, beginning of the fall. Like I said, we are still certified by the AMA. We can still grant AMA credits. We just can't grant AOA credits. But we're pretty good friends with a number of the organizations, so I'm sure we'll be able to swing that also. So everybody else, thank you so much. You know, it's getting on in time, and we'll see you again next week, same time, same station. Thank you all for coming. All right. Good night. Good night, John. Good night, Dr. Cruz. Well, the new folks, thank you for showing up, and we'll be here next week.